a lot of people try, when they're doing these things, they try to remove as much uncomfort or discomfort as possible. They try to mitigate as much of that discomfort or mitigate as much like hard times as possible, when in reality, they should be working more on like being okay and sitting in the discomfort and sitting in those hard times and learning how to train your mind to keep going even when it's difficult.
Right.
BT.
Who are these guests you keep booking here?
As a runner and wannabe runner, I'm really excited about this one.
Well, as a man who likes to feel masculine, I'm not excited about this one because I already feel like a girly man with this woman here. It's pretty impressive what she's done. 2,197 miles, 14 states, and 3 showers. That's a good woman right there.
That's my favorite part.
Yeah, right.
Three showers.
Yeah, yeah, Dirt. You finally found somebody who can live in your world of dirt. Tara Dower. That's exactly what happened earlier this year when at 1:53 p.m. on September 21st, this ultra-marathoner, ultra-badassery woman reached the southern terminus of the Appalachian Trail. Appalachian? Appalachian. Whichever it is. She's run from Maine to Georgia in only 40 days, 18 hours, and 5 minutes, beating the previous speed record by a whopping 13 hours. So how did she do? Well, we're going to talk about how she did in her incredible journey, and it's pretty aggressive to do something like that, and I'm glad that she's going to be talking about that. So today, welcome to the Aggressive Life, Tara Dower!
Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for being had. So tell me, ultra marathoning. How did you get into the ultra marathoning gig?
Oh, that's a really, really long story. I mean, it starts back from, I mean, when I was in high school, really. But I mean, a condensed version is I set a FKT on the Mount Sissi Trail and thought if I could run and hike 1,175 miles in 30 days, I could probably do a 100-mile race continuously. So I signed up for my first 100-miler, which was a year after I set the FKT on the Mountains of Sea Trail.
And hold on right there. What's FKT? I'm a neophyte here. What's FKT?
Yeah, it's fastest known time.
Oh, okay. Got it.
Yeah, the fastest known time record. So after setting that record, I thought that maybe I could sign up for an ultra marathon and complete a 100-mile race. So a year after I completed the MST FKT, I
What's MST?
Mountains of Sea Trail, fastest known time.
Okay. You're giving all kind of jargon here. I could give you theological jargon like sublapsarianism, all that stuff, you know, premillennial, postmillennial rapture. I could give you all kind of that stuff. So I just got to get educated.
We all have our things.
Yes, that's right. Sorry, keep going, Tara.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was really how I got into it. That's like the condensed version of how I got into ultra marathons and ultra running in general.
So ultra marathons is 100 miles plus? Is that what an ultra marathon is?
No, it's anything over the typical marathon distance. So pretty much starts at like 50K. So it's like 31 miles. And then anything above a typical marathon is an ultra marathon.
So what's it like for your body on an ultra marathon versus, you know, a marathon or a 10K? Is it really doesn't matter if you've trained or no, there's just different wear and tear?
I think there's different wear and tear. A marathon is definitely faster. So you're using different types of muscles to go quicker during a marathon. You know, an ultra marathon is just a sustained effort. You know, there are people that go really, really fast during ultra marathons, but yeah, for me, it's different types of muscles. It's different types of like mental games that you play during like a marathon compared to like an ultra.
Like, what's a mental game you'll play?
An ultra, you just kind of have to settle in and be okay with like the long haul. With a marathon, for me, I'm trying to like PR during the marathon, and it's usually like a road race. I don't
personal,
do a lot of
personal record. I yeah. do know PR, XYZ, PDQ. I know some of these things.
Yeah. Yeah. So like with the marathon, I'm usually trying to go quicker, and it's on a road. It's not on a trail, which is usually where I do a lot of my ultras. But on the road, it's more of like keeping up that consistent pace and being okay with the speed compared to like just settling in for the long haul.
You said that ultra marathons are different muscles than marathons. Really? They're a different strain on the muscle fibers or different muscles altogether?
Well, I mean, for me, typically I do my marathons on roads and do my ultras on trails. So it is different muscles. It's like with the trails, it's a lot of like, you know, climbing. The ones I do, it's a lot of climbing, and it's, you know, on trails. So there's a lot of rocks and there's a lot of roots. So there's like those little diversions in the trail, but on a road, it's pretty much the same muscles. I'm usually doing flat marathons and they're on roads, so it's a lot of like impact on your muscles on the road marathons.
I've never done a ultra marathon. I've never done a marathon. I always wanted to do a marathon, but my excuse is that my discs in my lower back just degraded too much. Just that pounding isn't good for me. I did a marathon ruck 2 years ago. It was really, really cool. And I do a number of other really difficult, strenuous things. So that's why I really wanted to hear your story. But when I'm doing those things, I'm curious what's going on with you. Like my motivation, I think about it all the time. What's my motivation for this? Sometimes I say my motivation is I just want to push myself and see my limits. Sometimes my motivation, like I'm gonna take my motorcycle, I'm gonna ride from Cincinnati to the end of the world this summer and camp the whole way up to Prudhoe Bay. It's gonna be a pretty brutal trip. Sometimes I want to say I just want to fight civilization, and I want to be uncomfortable. Sometimes I'll have a competitive thing in it that says, well, you know, someone has done it this way, but I just want to do it another way. Sometimes I feel like I learn more about myself when I'm uncomfortable. Sometimes I just, my mode is I want to do something that is not like anything else I've ever done. I normally can pinpoint which one of those things, or sometimes it's, I just want to try something new. I want to try something different.
Yeah.
So what do you think your base motivation is when you go out to do a ultra marathon?
It's kind of like what you're saying. It's a lot of different types of motivations. And I think I pull from different motivators, you know, in different situations and different races. So sometimes it is a competitive race and I'm trying to get a really good time or, you know, get on the podium. So it is a competitive motivation, but other times, like I just want to experience the trail and experience the community and the culture around the trail. Usually I'm doing these races in the mountains around cultures and communities that I haven't really spent a lot of time in. So I'm really trying to like invest my time into like, you know, I'm out there for usually like 20 plus hours if it's a mountain race. So I get a lot of exposure out there on the trail. So it's different motivations. It just depends on what race and what record I'm going for.
Are you an introvert?
I think I enjoy certain types of company. I don't think I'm like completely an introvert, but I think I have introverted tendencies, more introverted tendencies than I do extroverted tendencies.
Yeah, I would think you'd have to have it to be able to enjoy, and you got to have some level of enjoyment, even though there's difficulty there, to be able to enjoy hours upon hours of being by yourself. What's a normal amount that you're by yourself when you're racing? Is it like 5 hours, 6 hours?
When I'm racing, sometimes I'm around people. Usually in the start, I'm around people for maybe the first like 10 to 15 miles. And then my favorite distance is a 100-mile race. So usually I'm pretty much on my own for a majority of the race. And it honestly, the time goes by pretty quickly. If it's a mountain race, the time goes by pretty quickly out there. I listen to books.
Oh, you do? Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. I listen to books. I listen to podcasts. I have a lot of music that I listen to if I get bored.
Oh, okay. Because isn't the marathons, isn't that a no-no? You're not supposed to do a marathon with music, or is that just for Olympic trials or something like that?
I feel like you can use music in marathons. Maybe that's an Olympic trial thing. I haven't heard of that.
Yeah, that'd be actually horrible to be just with your own self and your own mind for. Maybe that says something about me. That'd be horrible. Yeah, man. If you could recapture the time with books and podcasts, whatever. What's some of your favorite stuff when you're on it? Is it like heavy metal grunge, or is it self help stuff, or what is it?
I mean, on the Appalachian Trail, I listen to a lot of different types of music. I tend to listen to a lot of true crime podcasts, which I can't quite get away from. And I listen to The Moth. The Moth is a storytelling podcast. It's a really interesting concept. They've been doing it for a really long time. And books, I listen to, it's mostly stories. Like I like John Krakauer
a lot.
Yeah, I like his storytelling a lot.
Yeah, Into Thin Air was fantastic. I thought his Under the Banner of Heaven was, I don't know, it was okay.
Mm-hmm.
But gosh, what's another one I haven't probably read? Clue me in. I probably need to get into one of his stuff.
Into the Wild.
Okay, I read that one. Has he done another one?
Let's see.
Actually, I don't know if I've read the book. I saw the movie and I thought it was Into the Stupid. I thought, seriously, dude, are you serious?
Just my opinion. He was a young kid. Right. Yeah, I used to look up to him a lot when I was in high school. Christopher McCandless. And then as I got older, I started realizing, like, I mean, he was a kid. He was out there. He had big goals, but he just didn't quite have – he had the right motivations, but I think his execution was poor.
Yeah, well, and good for him for trying to get off script. Mm-hmm. When I'm around somebody who's off script, which is – that's kind of why I'm intrigued with you and your story. I'm not really intrigued with long-distance running, but – I like that somebody has chosen a different course for their life that's beyond the norm, and that's why I'm kind of inspired by you. It's pretty cool, Tara.
Thanks.
Yeah. So let's talk about the Appalachian Trail. I know people who have done it before. Mm-hmm. If a lot of folks are really into this. My son-in-law, his father, had retired. He was getting older, and he decided to do the Appalachian Trail, which he really wasn't a physical fitness guy at all. And so he would map it out. This is before Kindle and before iPhones, or at least he didn't have any. And he would map it out to where he would read books and he would only take a section of the book. He'd rip it in half and then he'd have his family mail him, you know, other sections for him to do.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I could really dig the Appalachian Trail, I think. What was it like for you before we get into your PB WST, world record setting, whatever. Before we get into that specific run, what drew you to the Appalachian Trail?
Yeah. In 2012, 2013, I was in my dorm room and at East Carolina University, and I watched a documentary about the Appalachian Trail by National Geographic, and I was really intrigued by the culture of through hiking, the culture and the community around through hiking, and also the mountains, the Appalachian Trail, they're very historic mountains, not only in like the human history, but also just those are ancient mountains. And the biodiversity along the trail is incredible. You know, you might not get the most expansive view like you would in Colorado or in California in the Sierras, but on the Appalachian Trail, there's so much there's like these micro scenery, if you will, just like all the biodiversity, the animals, the flora, the fauna. It's my favorite mountain range just because of that. I mean, there's so much history involved with it. So, I mean, I attempted a thru hike in 2017 after graduating college and didn't quite make it due to a panic attack, and went back in 2019 and completed the trail in 5 months and 10 days and had the best journey of my life. It was an incredible adventure.
Tell us about the panic attack.
Yeah. 2017, I had a lot of untreated anxiety that I wasn't very familiar with techniques on how to holistically help yourself and, not use like medication. So I wasn't very aware of like how I can do that. I wasn't very familiar with panic attacks too. And like, especially like a physical manifestation of anxiety. And so I woke up on the eighth day of this through hike and just had chest pains and a migraine and was hyperventilating. And I couldn't quite get, calm. And I ended up leaving the trail and just realizing I needed to work on a lot of things. I needed to work on, you know, my motivations for being out there. I needed to figure out what those were. And I needed to work on the anxiety and figure out like, you know, what were the triggers that brought me to that point?
Yeah. What do you think that was at that point in your journey that panic set in?
Yeah. I think it built up over a span of like, I think for like five or six days. Like I had been feeling a lot of like this sense of dread and doom. And so in 2013, 2012, whenever I watched that documentary, I wanted to go out to the trail to experience the journey of hiking from Georgia to Maine. I wanted to experience, you know, the community and the culture. And as, you know, time went on, by the time it was 2017, the whole motivation was to just call myself a through hiker. Hmm. It was no longer about the journey. It was about just completing this thing and being able to tell people I through hiked the trail when, you know, before it wasn't about that. So I had to really figure out like, why was I out there in the first place? And, you know, to always be focusing on Mount Katahdin, the end of the trail, is really exhausting. So I had to really figure out like, how can I enjoy the journey? So by the time I got to Mount Katahdin in 2019, I was honestly like bummed because that meant like the life that I had developed for the last 5 months was going away. This life of waking up every day on the trail and being around my friends and hiking from sunrise to sunset, I wasn't able to do that. So by the time I finished, I was like, dang it. Yeah. So I think like I really experienced the trail the way it deserved in 2019. I'm glad I through hiked it then.
Yeah. So it sounds like it went from just an experiential journey to an identity thing. I need to have this check mark and goal oriented stuff that oftentimes trips us up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I had to really figure that out for myself and decipher those feelings from 2017.
When you're doing the trail, I know you can stop at little towns and hostels and hotels. You can map it out. But do people backpack it and just camp, pitch a tent every night? Is that possible?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, most of the nights I slept in the tent. There was maybe like every 6 days we might stay in a hotel. We might stay in a hostel, but mainly we're just sleeping on trail. And oftentimes you can go into towns to get your food supply and go back on trail and just, you don't have to like camp or you don't have to stay in a hotel or a hostel. You could camp the entire time if you'd like.
Right. So when you started, what time do you start EST?
In 2019, usually around like 8 a.m., maybe like 8:30 a.m.
Okay. That's not too bad.
Yeah.
I mean, if it was worse than that, I might LOL. I was wondering how many I could string together there. I only got two. I was writing them down. And you picked up on her pretty quick. Dirk knows my stupid ass sense of humor immediately when I started.
Oh, yeah, I was laughing.
All right. Tara, this is great. Thank you so much. You're so generous with your time and really insightful. I'm thinking already, like, man, I think I need to put the Appalachian Trail on my bucket list.
Oh, yeah. It's an incredible adventure. It changed my entire life.
I bet. So tell me about that. This is all preamble to the record, which is really cool, but change your whole life. Tell us about it.
Yeah. I, after 2019, I just realized I wanted to live life outdoors and spend as much time as I could on trails. And I've been lucky enough to now that's like my career. And now I literally make a living off of running on the trail. So that's really exciting.
How do you make a living of it? You have sponsorships and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I'm sponsored by Ultra Shoes.
That's awesome. That's great.
Yeah.
All right. So you're now, you love the Appalachian Trail at this point in the journey. You now have learned to like the journey. You're into the outdoors. You've crossed panic attack issues, and now you decide, I'm going to go for the record. Mm-hmm. Why did you want the record?
Yeah, it took a long time to get there. You know, I didn't finish in 2019 say I was going to go after the record. I was nowhere close to even doing a record in 2019. I mean, I was just a thru hiker at that point. I was just a backpacker. And so in 2019, I realized I wanted to spend more time on the trail. So I planned another thru hike, being the Mountains to Sea Trail, which we had talked about a little bit. And then COVID happened and I realized I couldn't do it in the typical way. In 2020, I couldn't do it, you know, as a through hike, because on the Mountains of Sea Trail, you have to rely a lot on the communities.
Interesting.
You know, on the Appalachian Trail, you can pretty much get away with like not seeing anyone or seeing people at all. You can restock, have a mask on and go back on trail. But with these communities you're going through, you have to rely on trail angels, along the trail. And it's also an urban trail too. So you're hiking, you're not just it's like 400 miles on the road, and it's like, you know, out of the 1,175 miles, it's 400 miles on the road. So, you know, I realized I couldn't do a regular through hike. So I decided, I was working for Jennifer Farr Davis at the time, who held the overall Appalachian Trail FKT, but that got beat a couple years after. It was a little bit before someone beat her time. But then she held the women's record before I beat it. But I was working for her as a backpacking guide and as a hostel caretaker. And was incredibly inspired by her and decided I would do the Mountains to Sea Trail as a fastest known time record. And that way it was a supported record. I could have like this little quarantine crew traveling with me along the trail. We didn't really have to interact with these communities or these high risk populations. A lot of these trail angels are like older folks. So
what is that? Stop for a minute. You said community trail angels. Mm-hmm. Who are these people? What do they do? How often are they around?
Yeah, there's a list on like Friends of the Mountains to Sea Trail website, and it's just people that who live close to the trail who are offering like any support. Like they could pick you up, take you to a grocery store, you can stay at their house.
Oh, cool.
Like there are fire stations along the trail, you could sleep. You could pitch a tent because it is an urban trail. You can't just like post off to the side of the road. You have to find these like places that you're allowed to camp. So you had to interact a lot with these trail angels is what we call them. People who would like allow you to like sleep in their house and stuff. Yeah.
Interesting. That's really intriguing. I didn't realize it was 400 miles on pavement. I'm less inclined to do it now. I didn't realize it was that much.
Oh, this is the Mountains to Sea Trail.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're off the Appalachian Trail. Which is the Mount to Sea Trail?
Yeah, the Mountains to Sea Trail is, I decided after 2019, I wanted to thru hike another trail.
Decided
the Mountains to Sea Trail was the one I was going to do.
And what trail is that? Where's it go from? From where to where?
Yeah, it's Clingman's Dome to Jockey's Ridge. It's across the state of North Carolina.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So Appalachian Trail, if I do that, I'm not going on road for a long way.
Yeah, no.
Good. I like it.
Yeah. So, I mean, this was the trail I wanted to do. After being inspired by Jennifer Farr Davis, I decided to get this quarantine crew and not interact with these high-risk populations and set the fastest known time on the Mountains to Sea Trail. And it was about 29 days. And then after that, that is when I decided to do ultra marathons. And I, you know, signed up for my first ultra marathon a couple months after the fastest known time on the Mountains to Sea Trail, and did my first 100 miler a year after. And then since then I've done about 10 100 milers, and I've done 20 something ultras. And I've also done several other fastest known time attempts. So I've done the Colorado Trail, and I've done the Bent McKay Trail, And after the Bette McKay Trail, after that fastest known time, I felt okay. It was 4 days and change, and I felt okay. Like, I was tired and I was hungry, but I felt like I could probably keep going if I wanted to. And this was 2 years prior to this year, you know, 2024, when I started the Appalachian Trail. So I thought, like, I think I might, you know, entertain the idea of going for the fastest known time on the Appalachian Trail. And at this time, I had made so many connections in the world of, like, FKTs, specifically with the Appalachian Trail.
Oh yeah, FKTs, right, right.
Yeah, that I...
that what is an FKT? What's an FKT?
Yeah, FKT, it's...
WTF, I don't know these.
The... fastestknowntime.com. They're okay, like governing body of these like record attempts on trails.
You did say that before and I forgot because I have the memory of a gerbil. So yes, I'm sorry about that.
That's okay. Yeah. So yeah, after the Bette McKay Trail, that's kind of where the idea started.
So when you're doing these, Tara, you're running or you're fast walking with a backpack or what's happening?
During FKTs, it depends on the type of FKT you're doing. So there's three different categories. There's supported, self-supported, and unsupported.
Oh, okay.
So generally with unsupported and self-supported, you are carrying like all your backpacking supplies. But with supported, if you're going fully supported, which is what I did on most of my FKTs, then you typically are just carrying like a small pack and you have a crew that resupplies you at road crossings with food and water.
What's the difference between unsupported and self-supported?
Yeah, self-supported is essentially you can restock your food supply, you can get new shoes, you can, you know, take showers, you can do everything to support yourself, but you can't like receive any outside help from anyone. With unsupported, you can't restock your food supply. You can't buy new shoes. You can't do anything.
Oh my gosh.
Except just use the stuff that's in your pack and, you know, that's all you have.
Wow. You start off with what's in your pack for that whole time, multi-states, and you can't resupply. You can't do that. It is what it is.
Well, there's a lot of different types of FKTs. So there's like ones that are like 200 miles, like 100 miles.
Okay.
So nobody's ever done an unsupported Appalachian Trail FKT. That seems a little impossible.
Right. That I'm thinking, sheesh, you start off with 100 pounds of Cliff Bars just off the bat.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. So building up to your record-setting attempt, How had you, did you go into that thinking panic isn't going to be a problem? I started this thinking I wanted to stay on the physical aspect of it, which I want to stay there for sure. But I just interact with so many people who are dealing with mental illness and so many people who have got anxiety issues that you're sort of you're in a pressure cooker sort of situation where I've got to think that some of the things that you're doing and coping with have got to be helpful for the average Joe who's not going to even do what you're doing but still deals with it. So what were your strategies going into it?
Yeah, I didn't – from like all my experience since like 2017, like all my experience along trails, I've done so many, you know, I don't even know, thousands of miles on trails since then. And – I haven't really, it feels way different when I'm on trails. It feels like I'm somewhere I belong. I feel not as much anxiety. I feel very welcomed and calm in the outdoors now. I think there was a lot in 2017 that like fed into all that anxiety. And I think I've been able to overcome a lot of those feelings, which feels great. So, you know, I knew anxiety might be, you know, a part of some factors. Like if I wasn't on record pace, like maybe I might feel anxiety there. Or if I was injured, like I had anxiety about like possibly getting injured and having to stop, but, it wasn't like super prevalent.
So it was the first time when you were in a different element and then you just sort of learned the gig with camping and being outdoors and came to love it. So there was less to stress about.
Yeah. Yeah. I just kept exposing myself to those stressors, I guess you could say.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. I think that's maybe that's why it's such a runaway problem in our society. There's so many understandable reasons for it, for sure. But I also have to think that one of the things is that very few of us try something new. Very few of us try something difficult. Our entire economy is wired to make your life easier. Our entire economy and business model of America is to make life simple and comfortable. Everything is about that.
Yeah.
And so the least bit of change, the least bit of discomfort, and we're just not conditioned for it.
Yeah, I often say comfort is the death of creativity. I don't know if that's a quote somewhere, but that just always comes to mind because I feel my most like creative, and I feel like my most like I'm really developing whatever it is. Like I feel like I'm becoming more of a whole person when I am discomfort. In discomfort.
Have you read Michael Easter's The Comfort Crisis?
No.
Oh, Tara.
Is it good?
Get ready for a PR. It's oh my gosh. Oh, we had him on the podcast a while ago. Derek, we should probably have him again. He wrote it's a best-selling book, Comfort Crisis, and he just goes into the science and the data, and beyond that, just his own personal experience and cultures around the world that have embraced things that are uncomfortable and how it's just a crisis. We have a crisis in our country because we're too comfortable. I find it incredibly compelling.
Yeah. I mean, you just look at I was on the trail for 40 days and only slept in an actual bed, like in a hotel once. Mm-hmm. And you know, once I got back to a house and running water, I was so amazed at I remember washing my hands. I passed by a gas station as I was going through Duncannon and I went in and washed my hands. Cause my hands, I don't have running water out there. And so oftentimes I'm not washing my hands like I should. And the warm water was just amazing to me.
Right.
And we are so not that it's a bad thing. I think it's a good thing that we're spoiled with all these amenities, but you know, if you're so used to it, I think, you know, people should become a little more discomforted. I don't think that's a word. Is that a word? Anyways, I think people should embrace more of that discomfort. And I think that gives a little more appreciation to the things that we just take for granted, like hot running water. I was like, this is insane. And also a mirror. I remember looking in the mirror in Duncannon and seeing my face. Cause at that point I had become this machine that was just moving down the trail. Yeah. And I felt looking at my face, it was a human face and I wasn't feeling that. I think, you know, we can really take those things for granted.
Well, he has a chapter in the book which details that the dirtiest people in the world are the healthiest. Dirt, please don't take any.
I'm texting my wife right now.
Yeah, right. By the way, I'm looking at your freaking shoe. Dude, it's wintertime. You still have your
Chacos
on.
Always.
Oh, my gosh. He's so dirty. That's why I call him Dirt. But anyway, I think it would probably inspire you while you're running. I think you'd dig it. So just my opinion.
Yeah, I wrote it down.
Yeah, Comfort Crisis by Michael Easter. Let's get him on the podcast again, Derek. Some time has passed.
Yeah, totally.
I would love to do that. Okay, so anyway, now you're starting. Take us through the big day when it starts. I know it wasn't an 8:30 start, so let's get to the race or the personal record, the world record. Tell us what was going on there.
Yeah. Me and Rascal, who is my crew chief, we slept in the Baxter State Park in Maine because I was going southbound. Huh. And we started hiking up to the northern terminus, Mount Katahdin, at, what was that, 2 or 3 a.m. when we started. We got up there at 3, or we got up there at 5:40, ish, and I started at 5:47 a.m. and touched the sign and just started moving south. And honestly, you know, people ask me, they're like, how did it feel when you finish? How did it feel when you start? And when I look back, it's like, it was just another part of the adventure. Like all of these moments that went into like the middle part, the end, the beginning, it's all just part of the same moment, I guess.
Right. And when you're doing that, are you, what's your heart rate at? Are you huffing and puffing the whole time, or what's going on?
Yeah, at this point I was going down. So I was, you know, leaving the mountain, and I was going down and through Baxter State Park, and I've started entering the 100-mile wilderness, and it's generally pretty easy going trail besides like the very start Mount Katahdin. When you're coming off the mountain, it's very rocky, but yeah, my heart rate, I just, you know, you want to keep the effort pretty consistent and you want to just keep it pretty low. You don't, on these FKTs, you're not like sprinting or like even running hard the entire time. You're just trying to stay consistent.
Yeah. And I think I've heard about the rock part. Is this the part if you're going south to north where you got to be on all fours to go up? Someone was telling me about that it's really gnarly.
There is a mile in Maine, in southern Maine, 200 some miles into the trail going south. It's the hardest mile on the trail. And yeah, it's basically like bouldering, and it takes people on average about 50 minutes to complete this 1 mile in southern Maine.
Okay. 5-0 isn't too bad.
Yeah. It's a Mahusick notch.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're going on for the record, and you said you're just in it. So there's no days that stick out that are worse or better than other days. You're just, your mindset is, I'm doing this thing and I got to hit these metrics.
Yeah, there was definitely really great days, and there's definitely really hard days. And I guess there's not like anything that sticks out. There's different moments, and they were hard for different reasons.
Give us one.
In Virginia, it was really, really hot that day, and I was behind on my pace. So I just felt like I wasn't doing well that day. And I just got in my head, and it was really hot, and it was just it was really tough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You start second guessing yourself. Why am I doing this? All that sort of thing, I bet.
No, I mean, I never wanted to quit during the FKT. I just, you know, I knew that moments like this would happen. Like, it's really, a lot of people try, when they're doing these things, they try to remove as much uncomfort or discomfort as possible. They try to mitigate as much of that discomfort or mitigate as much like hard times as possible, when in reality, they should be working more on like being okay and sitting in the discomfort and sitting in those hard times and learning how to train your mind to keep going even when it's difficult. So I never really like, I trained myself to like, you know that those things were coming, and when they came, how was I going to interact with it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In your normal day-to-day life, when things are really hard, are there transferable lessons and principles you take from the trail to your normal life? And if so, what are they?
Yeah, of course. You know, maybe if there's like, I've been going through a lot of like personally hard moments, like family, with family, and it's been pretty tough these last couple months. And when I think about those moments, it feels like they can last forever. And this really hard time in my life is never going to end, and I'm never going to be okay. But something I take from the trail is knowing that it's like a roller coaster. You're going to have really low moments, but you know, it could be days from now, it could be hours from now, but you're going to have a high moment. It's going to happen again. You're not always going to feel this amount of, you know, hardship or sadness.
Yeah. The emotional difficulty for most of us is much more harsh than the physical difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, put yourself on a trail or on a bike on a long road. Those are good, but tough, but man, the emotional stuff is what just wears me out.
Yeah, crushing. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it has a lot of like, you know, those emotional turmoils can also feed into like your physical body too. And like I said, with the anxiety in 2017, like it was very much in my head, but then it became this physical manifestation. And I actually like a couple weeks ago got sick. And I think it's because, you know, being in the state that I'm in, like having a lot of things going on, you know, your immune system can diminish. Right. And I think there's something real about like when you are feeling, you know, some turmoil, it can manifest physically.
Yeah. We promoted a guy here in our, my day job. I don't know if you know or not. My day job is a pastor mm-hmm. by day. And so we promoted a guy, into a really significant role, into a quote unquote lead pastor role. So he's been doing things that like only I had done. And we just had a really, really grueling season and he was sick. And Kyle never really gets sick. I just don't see it. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you know why that is? I said, no, I said, because we just went through this grueling push mm-hmm. and you had a lot on your back and your defenses are down and it mm-hmm. ended. And it's almost like your body says, oh, I'm good now. I can get sick now because I'm really tired. And boom, you do. And he looked at me like, yeah, hell, that happens all the time with me. I don't think that we understand fully the energy thing. I used to hear the whole energy discussion. I used to think, oh, that just sounds like talking about Martians. What do you mean energy? But it is true. There's, I don't know what it is inside of our blood, inside of our soul, inside of our bones, but there is some energy quotient that has to be managed. And no question, the emotional to the spiritual, to the physical, to the familial, to all these things suck into our energy and we only have so much to give.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
I had a doctor explain it to me once, which is when I finally started taking drugs, when I got hurt. He said, look, man, I know you're not going to want to take drugs for the pain. Let me tell you how this works. Your body only has so much energy. So you can take your body's energy to heal your injury, or you can use your energy to cope with the pain. I recommend you don't cope with the pain. Use all your energy to heal. I was like, mm-hmm. once you said that, from then on in, I was like, great. If I'm prescribed medication for pain, I'll take it.
That's a great way to explain that.
It was. Yeah. I understood it. I was always no, until I became a believer in the energy piece. Mm. I mean, you've got mastering your energy and building your energy. And I do believe we can expand our energy. Some people just have smaller reservoirs of energy than other people mm-hmm. do. By birth, by DNA. But I think whatever your reservoir is, I think you can expand that energy reservoir, but none of us have a bottomless energy reservoir. Mm-hmm. And you better darn learn how to manage whatever energy you have, or your life is just not going to work.
Yeah.
Tara, you and I got to go do something sometime. We got to camp or something. I'm not going to run an ultra marathon with you, but man, I'd love to sit around a campfire with you. That'd be a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah.
So when you cross the finish line, what is it? Is it exuberance or is it, oh, no, a goal's done. Bummer. What's it like?
I think it was a little of both of those things. I mean, a lot of people like to think that this was so hard and it was so grueling the entire time. I was exhausted. And I mean, 54 miles a day to anyone sounds exhausting, and it was exhausting. But I also really enjoyed my time out there. I had a lot of great people come out and pace me. I had a lot of sunrises, sunsets in Virginia. As we know, I love the trail. I absolutely love it. So it was a great experience. So by the time I got to the end, like, I was happy to be done. I was happy to have set this record and, you know, just continuing the conversation about women and endurance and how, you know, it is coming out that we are exceptional beings in this endurance realm. And I'm happy to like keep proving that, keep being one of those women that is proving that. But like, I was sad and I think it was a little both of those things.
Yeah, that's a great thing I wanted to get on too. Yeah, there's no question that women are superior to men in the ultra marathoning world. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Yeah, I think obviously like there's a certain point to where men are, you know, exceeding, you know, women. And, you know, I don't know exactly that distance. I'd have to do more research on that. But there is a point where like the physical differences in men and women, it doesn't really matter. And, you mm-hmm. know, we become equal in a way.
But you're not equal. Women aren't equal in ultramarathon. I thought you're far beyond. Like, if you have the top 10 ultramarathoners in the world, how many of them are women?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, if you're looking at like the 100-mile distance, men are still winning those races.
Oh, really?
But there is a certain point, and I think that's shortly after the 100-mile distance where the physical difference start. They don't start mattering anymore. And there's, you know, I've won races overall. Like I just did a 50K this weekend and I got second overall. Hmm. And it just depends on like who's in the field. Like it's really dependent on that. But if you take the best men and the best women and race them in a 100-mile race, the men are most likely going to make up most of the top 10.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you go out and you run 100 meters, what do you think your time is in 100 meters?
Oh,
I'd be about 20 seconds. That's what I would be.
As the 100, yeah, I don't know. I'm pretty quick.
Oh, you are quick. That's what I was getting at. You are quick, huh?
Yeah, I played rugby in college and was the fullback. So I took the ball and sprinted up the field and got tries. And I beat a lot of people. And that was also like college rugby. It wasn't anything like it was club rugby. So there wasn't anyone that was like pros in this, but you know, I was pretty quick and, I can get down with 100 mile or 100 meter.
Interesting. So you have the fast twitch muscle fibers as well as the, whatever they're called, slow twitch, long-term endurance stuff. You're in both those realms.
I think so. I'm not like the fastest person, I'm not super duper fast. If I trained, I could probably get way faster, but yeah, I think I might have both of those fibers.
That's cool. That's very cool. I didn't know you could have both of them, but if anyone would, that would be you. That's cool. So how long of a train is this for you? You certainly can run long distances for a long, long time, but what's it look like as far as just breaking down of your body tissues, aging, all that stuff?
Yeah.
Or is that a depressing question to ask you?
No, it's not depressing. I get that a lot. And I don't know. I'm not sure the science behind that, but the way I see it, you know, people ask me that and they ask me like, oh, how could you do this? It just seems like your body's going to break down so much faster. And I'm like, well, we all have our things that we do that, you know, we enjoy that bring a lot of joy to our lives that might not be the best for us. And it's all about like, you know, the quality of your life. And it's not so much like how much life you've lived. For me, it's like how much life, like what's the quality of the life that I've lived?
Well, maybe you also can get more engaged in some of the work that you're really passionate about. Like I'd like you to talk about Girls on the Run, what that's mm-hmm. all about.
Yeah. Yeah. Girls on the Run, I partnered with them during the Appalachian Trail. And my goal was to raise $20,000 for that nonprofit. And we ended up raising $100,570.
Something like that.
Yeah, whatever that is. A lot of money. It was a lot of money. And I'm really thankful for the entire community that came together and was inspired by the Appalachian Trail so much that they gave a lot of money. Some people gave significant amounts of money. And I'm really thankful the community came together for that.
But what does Girls on the Run do? What's the goal?
Yeah, Girls on the Run, they are a program. It's put on in a lot of like major cities, but they also have some programs in like smaller cities as well, or smaller towns. But essentially they get girls who, I think they start at age 8 and they have different age groups, but they teach them running skills, these after school programs. But on top of that, they also teach them life skills, mental, emotional skills. And a big focus for them is confidence building, because at age 8, you know, there's a steady incline for young girls at age 8 with their confidence. And at age 8, all of a sudden it drops off. You know, there's the prevalence at that age of like You know, maybe they are getting their first crush. They have a lot of friends that they're interacting with. Maybe social media is coming in at their, in that time. And so there's a huge drop off in confidence for those girls at age 8. So they're really trying to build the confidence of these young girls and, show them what's possible.
Tara, I really wish I had more time with you because I feel like I'm just getting started. This has been really, it's been great. I've enjoyed it greatly. But I've got a bunch of little things that I haven't gotten to get into, but I just got to get real quick ones, like one sentence, one question, one.
Oh, no.
Can you do it?
I over-explain, so. This
okay, can't do it. If you over-explain, then I only get to ask you like two final questions. But I got a number of them. I think they're real quick hitters. All right, okay, here we go. Favorite wildlife you saw on the trail?
Bobcat.
Ooh. Mm-hmm. Favorite state you ran through on the AT?
Virginia.
Most challenging section on the, that's AT as in Appalachian Trail, in case you don't know that. AT.
The White Mountains in New Hampshire.
How many times you fall?
Probably over 500 times.
Wow. Okay, I got to stop. You're doing great, by the way. You can do this really well. 500 times. You're a tough lot. Woman. Sheesh. That's...
Yeah, that was pretty much the reason why I didn't think I'd get the record up until the last 3 miles, because I fall so violently that I thought that I could, you know, break a kneecap or dislocate a shoulder and not be able to continue.
Oh, my gosh. All right. Favorite food on the Appalachian Trail?
Oh, food became a job. I would say any wrap that Amy made for me was pretty good.
Scariest moment on the trail?
When a man, it was dusk, and a man who was clearly not a backpacker or a hiker, who was a local, told me and my girlfriend, who was pacing me at the time, that we better get off the trails before dark. And it was very threatening. It was not nice.
Wow.
Yeah.
First thing you wanted to do when you finished the trail?
Sleep.
All right, and then last thing, this is more open-ended question is, what do you think the secret is to building resilience in every area of life?
I think it's maybe curiosity. If you have that natural curiosity to build resilience, you're going to do that. But if you have no desire to build resilience in your life, then you know, there's no reason to do that. But I think if you have curiosity in that realm, I think that's a first step.
I like it. Tara, is there anything you wanted to talk about that we haven't had a chance to talk about yet?
I don't think so. I think we covered a lot.
Yeah, you've been a great guest. Tara, if someone wants to follow up with you, see some of your stuff, interact with any of your content, where do they go?
Yeah, I vlogged the entire FKT on the Appalachian Trail on my YouTube channel called Tara Treks, TaraTreks. And you can follow me on Instagram at Tara, TARA.Dower, DOWER.
Hey, everybody. This has been a really, really great thing. You could look at this as, an interesting world of ultra marathoning and hiking I hadn't thought of before. And that's fine if you look at it that way. But just remember, this is called the aggressive life. There's supposed to be something here that you actually do. Maybe it is you're going to do a trail run. Maybe it is that you're going to try to do a personal record in some area of your life. Or maybe it is just you're going to embrace difficulty. You're going to put yourself in a situation where there's an X factor of the unknown, and you're going to increase your overall capacities and maybe even your overall energy. Find something that applies to your life. Make it happen. We'll see you next time on The Aggressive Life.
Awesome.
Thanks for joining us on this journey toward aggressive living. Find more resources, articles, past episodes, and more at briantome.com. My new book, a 60-day devotional called The 5 Marks of a Man, 60 Days to a Powerful Life, along with all the other books in the 5 Marks library, are open right now on Amazon. Be sure to leave us a rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. Then send an email to dirt. That's dirt at briantome.com to get a free Aggressive Life sticker. Find more on Instagram at briantome. The Aggressive Life is a production of Crossroads Church, Cincinnati, Ohio.